Okay. I'm going to call the Health, Education, and Social Services meeting together. This is March 1st, and it came in like a lion. And it is 5 minutes after 3, and members present are Representative Sisna, Representative Gardner, Representative Seaton, Representative Roses, and myself, Wilson. And our HES secretary is Kelly Burnett, and our moderator is Chris Spanish. So I will tell you the order of business, and then we'll get right down to things. First of all, we're going to hear House Bill 100 and a presentation on strengthening families. And we also have a little bit of housekeeping to do. So Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to make a motion that we move the zero fiscal note for HER 10 from committee and to follow the bill.
All right. Hearing no objection, so moved.
Oh. Excuse me, just a question. I don't remember. What is HER 10?
Oh, that was the Denali, the bill that we
medical
passed.
Medical assistance for children. I
yes.
Think. Okay.
And
thank you.
We didn't have the fiscal note that day, and uh-huh. So we're just passing this on so we can it can catch up with the bill.
That was the housekeeping issue. Correct?
Yes.
See, there,
yes.
That is proof that Representative Seaton does do housekeeping.
We'll have to tell his wife.
That's right.
Okay, next up is House Bill 100, Air Ambulance Service, and Representative Coghill, would you like to come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Coghill from District 11, and I'm glad for you that you get to see this next presentation after me, because it'll lift your spirits. This one just is probably a much more mundane issue compared to the strengthening families. So, and I really appreciated their work. And I'm saying that because I'm going to be out of here in a few minutes. House Bill 100 came up because of a question that happened over a ambulance service that wanted to offer a service that could only be offered by nonprofits, and they were for profit. That was the first question. The next question is it even insurance? And in working with our insurance director, it became clear to me that subscription service is really not insurance, and there's no pooling. It's a person-to-person, it's a person-to-business relationship. There are some issues where you're guaranteed, but under this particular bill, what we're going to say is it's not. We're also going to say that if you offer it, that you cannot deny service. So it was brought up before that people couldn't refuse ambulance service. Well, we're going to say that in statute. If you sell subscription service, you must perform that service. So. Obviously, I think that's a. I mean, you heard from last testimony that they're never going to deny service. This is just kind of codifies that. Let me tell you the philosophy that comes from this. Comes from me. I like it when the market dynamics work in an industry best, and what this does is allows a group of people who offer a service to appeal to customers to give them some comfort that service will be delivered kind of puts both parties on notice that you have subscribed to it, we're going to perform it. It's a way of for the company side, it's a way of getting the benefit of the business. From the customer side, is from getting the benefit of the service. It's a kind of an interesting contractual relationship. You heard testimony last time, Madam Chair, from somebody who had some problems with it, and so I'm going to try to get out of the way and let you get somebody who can testify to give you kind of a balance of the conversation. It is true that in this industry, there's probably only 6 providers in Alaska, and there's various different levels of service. And you're going to hear about various different contracts, but the fact is it's going to be somewhat competitive. On the other hand, there are going to be places where you want that assurance that with your provider that you don't have to even concern yourself with the copay issue. And if somebody can figure out a way to do that, that's kind of inventing the bitter mousetrap. And I like the idea when we invent the bitter mousetrap in the world. So quite frankly, it's a growing industry. So we haven't figured out all the nuances, and you're going to hear some testimony. We should put all kinds of bells and whistles on this, but I think we should go kind of slowly into this. The levels of service that are delivered, I'm going to say everybody should have the benefit of entering into a service agreement with people at whatever level they're in. There are other states that only allow it at certain levels, certain bonding levels and things like that. I don't know that we want to start there in Alaska. I think we want everybody to be able to grow. And you heard that this is one way of thwarting that business. My attitude is level out the playing field. Everybody could come in and do this if they want, or they can provide another service that may be even better that goes beyond this. So with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to leave. I'm going to let Ms. Lidster, who's my staff member, who probably knows all the details and all the arguments much better than I. But I would appeal to you to allow, we have, I think, one member calling in online who, is that, I think Mr. Sterling is his name, who probably could bring some questions up. Am I correct on that? Not yet? Okay. I told him 3 o'clock. And then there are some people that actually flew in. And given this weather, I'd have to give them high marks for that, who are here from Guardian Air that could speak to it, too. So, Madam Chair, because of the questions you asked last time, I would encourage you to get the testimony, and then we can come in and talk about the specifics of the bill.
And just so that there's no misunderstanding, I want to hear as much testimony as we can today on the bill, but we are not going to move the bill today.
And that's fine with me. In fact, in the conversation you find amendments that are open, I would just encourage get them to me so that we can talk about them and I can understand the direction. But if it makes it a better way to go, I'm game.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Before Representative Coghill, the sponsor, leaves, did you say that there are about 6 providers in the state?
To my knowledge, it's 6.
Okay. I have here, and I don't know where my staff got this, but it's entitled a list, Air Medical Services, broken down by region, and there's like 18 mm-hmm. providers under that title, Air Medical Services. But, you know, we haven't called them. Maybe some of them aren't in business.
Probably you're going to hear more from professionals way beyond me, but my guess is there are various different certifications, and you'll have some people who have a Cessna 180 who can haul people off, but they don't have any EMS, they don't have anybody available, but they can still fly under certain circumstances. So that's probably the issue, but I will defer to the experts on that one.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I know we had ahead of time heard that there was somebody from California that was going to call in and somebody from Mexico that was going to call in. So the minute you get any of those people, give that information to me, and we'll try to get them on first. But we don't have that now. So what we're going to do is Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While you're thinking about people who are going to call in or participate, I tried to reach Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance.
She's here.
I don't see her. Okay.
She's hiding.
Okay, good. Okay.
Now, what I was wanting to do is to get someone, actually, let me look here at my list. Brief at ease. Okay. Is there a Kathy McLaren? McLaren? Yes.
McLaren.
Sorry. Come on.
Madam Chair, members of the HES Committee, my name is Kathy McLaren.
and I'm here with the Department of Health, the Division of Public Health, Section of Injury Prevention and EMS, and we're the organization that credentials Air Medical Services for the Health Department, and we were available mostly to answer questions that you might have. I see the first question you asked was certified EMS organizations, air EMS organizations in this state. We've actually have 19 air certificates issued to 14 different agencies in Alaska, five of whom are native health organizations, two are to hospital-based services, two are either borough or government agencies, four are private, and one is a military organization. And so we were here to provide answers to questions you might have about the various levels of certification or the requirements for certification as an air medical agency in Alaska.
Why don't you go start at the top, and or I'll start at the bottom, and then work your way up to the most complex.
Madam Chair, may I but in just a minute,
yes.
Representative Coghill, because the bill is dealing with for-profit, that might be the better place to start to show the difference between for-profit and non-profit.
Okay, that sounds good to me. All right, go right ahead and start with a nonprofit then.
Well, Madam Chair, we really don't separate out air medical certifications based on their profit status or based on the organizational status. We say basically that the requirements for credentialing as an air medical person, you need to apply with our department. And we have three levels of certificate. One is a medevac service, one is a critical care or ambulance service, and the third is a specialty aeromedical transport team. And the requirements are different for each level. As a medevac service, you need to be an air service, a hospital, a medical clinic, or a certified EMS agency. You must have licensed or certified personnel available to provide care, one of whom has to have had a 16-hour aeromedical specialty training course. You need to have the appropriate aeromedical equipment for the level of care you're going to provide as a medevac service. You need to have a medical director. As a critical care or ambulance, you need to have licensed personnel, so that's paramedics, nurses, physician assistants, or physicians. You still need to have appropriate aircraft, appropriate equipment for the care you're going to provide, and the medical director requirements are a bit different. And for a specialty aeromedical transport team, that means that you're designated a particular class of patient, pediatric, neonatal, high-risk maternal, and you need to have people that are licensed and experienced in that profession, and the medical direction needs to be able to speak to that specialty. And so that's how we, the credential. In addition to the requirements from the Department of Health to be certified as an air medical service in Alaska, there are other organizations that have requirements. The FAA, for example, has specific aircraft requirements that air operators must also meet. You know, there's other business models. If you're going to do billing, then there's, you know, compliance with the CMS requirements and the insurance requirements, etc. We and our agency limit ourselves to making sure they comply with our regulations in our statutes.
Okay. Well, we have several questions here, so Representative Seaton, then Representative Roses, and then Representative Garden.
Thanks. Within those classifications, how many are with each classification of the 19 that you said were issued?
Representative Seaton, through the chair. We have 10 certified critical care or ambulance certificates. We have 8 certified medevac services, and we have 1 specialty transport team certification. But several organizations hold more than one certificate. That's 19 certificates, but it's 14 agencies.
Okay. And follow up. And in our bill, we're talking about certified under 18-08-082. Is that all of these, or did it encompass only one part of that certification?
Yes, that section of our statutes talks about the health department will write regulations, and the regulations that I was referring to is down in the 7AAC 26s. The article 3 talks about the regulations, and that's where we differentiate between those three levels of service. So yes, all of those are contained in the 1808.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, Representative Roses.
Thank you. The question that I have, and I don't know how long you've been working in this area where the certification process takes place, but have you seen or experience a considerable amount of turnover in terms of the number of people that are licensing from year to year? Do we see a lot of consistency, or do we see, you know, a lot of vacancy? I mean, does it go up and down a lot? That's my concern.
Representative, through the chair, there is a small variation in the number of services. Recently, a couple of services have considered whether they wanted to carry two certifications like they had been, or whether they just wanted to carry one certificate, but the same organization is still credentialed in Alaska. And I think, I have my colleague Shelley Owens here with me. We did have one out-of-state provider not elect to renew a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. So the numbers are reasonably stable.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you. I don't know if this is, if you're the appropriate person for this question, but if you're not, maybe you could tell us who we could ask. Are Alaskans, by and large, currently well-served by air ambulance services? Are there populations who would be better served under this bill, or do you have an opinion about that?
I don't think the department is taking a position on this bill. I think that Alaskans right now, when they need to be moved from where they are to more to definitive care, whether that's you're in a very remote village and you need to move into a regional hub like Bethel Barrow, Dillingham, or if you're at a regional hub and you need to move into more definitive care like Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Seattle, there are air medical services that can provide that service for you. And the referral patterns are well known to the people who are working in those clinics. So if I'm a mid-level, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you who I was. I am a PA, I am a paramedic, I'm a certified flight paramedic. I worked in the air medical industry for almost 7 years out of Barrow. So I do have experience as a provider as well as a state regulator. and if I was a mid-level working out in a community, I certainly know the air medical services that serve my area. I know how to contact them, and I can get care for my patients.
Follow-up, President Gardner.
Thank you. Maybe a better way to phrase the question that's in my mind is, do you see this bill as being about improving access to necessary medical services, or would you say it's more about business models?
The reason the health department is not taking a position on this bill is we do view this as a business model, and our statutory authority and regulations speak to, do you have appropriate aircraft, appropriate medical equipment, appropriately credentialed medical providers, appropriate medical direction, and we're currently not in a certificate of need program. We're currently in a market-driven program, and if you meet the requirements, you apply to us, you will be credentialed.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Roses.
I'll save my question for later. I think it may fit better after we have some more testimony.
All right. No more questions. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Shelley Deering?
Good afternoon, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. My name is Shelley Deering. I am the Alaska Director of Clinical Operations for Airlift Northwest, and I reside in Juneau. I'm a critical care flight nurse, and I am the manager of our medically related operations in Alaska. Airlift Northwest was created in 1982 after a house fire in Sitka that claimed the lives of five children who were unable to be transported to a regional burn center. After 25 years and 55,000 patients later, we are still serving Southeast Alaska as a nonprofit air medical service. We're the only service with two dedicated Learjets in Southeast Alaska in Juneau and Ketchikan. We have 14 nurses and pilots that reside in each community to provide this service. It has been our honor and our privilege to serve Alaskans. I'm here today to express concern about House Bill 100. This legislation seeks to provide Alaskans with the ability to participate in subscription or membership programs for air medical transportation. This type of program offers a discounted medical service for a fee. Rarely will insurance cover all of the cost of a transport. Under a subscription program, the patient's copay, or the amount not covered by insurance or Medicare, will be covered through the membership fee. We are concerned, however, that House Bill 100 could have serious unintended consequences. In fact, it could jeopardize some of the state's air medical programs. Currently, Alaska has, and I had 16 state-certified air medical services. I knew some of them were classified twice. Some cover rural areas, and others cover the state as a whole. Membership programs can result in a competitive environment in which smaller programs would be at a distinct disadvantage. They may not have the resources necessary to set up a viable program. Conceivably, some could be driven out of business, leaving areas of the state without service. It's important to remember, too, that subscription programs are like any other health care program. When one person pays less for the actual cost of a service, which occurs when you purchase a subscription, another person pays more. Unfortunately, this differential pricing is the reality of our health care system. I'd also like to call your attention to Section 1 of this bill, which requires that organizations offering subscription programs may not deny emergency medical service to any person. On the surface, this would seem like an admirable policy, but if it is interpreted broadly, patients could suffer. The problem lies in the definition of emergency. For example, if a person falls in Juneau and breaks their hip, that is an emergency, one that can be treated effectively at Bartlett Hospital. However, under Section 1, this person could request a flight program to take them to Anchorage. Not only would this drive up the cost of treatment, it could take an aircraft out of service that could be needed for a much more serious emergency. We also are concerned that this legislation would exempt subscription programs from any type of insurance regulation. We believe that subscription programs are a form of insurance. We met with Linda Hall, the Alaska Insurance Commissioner, on February 9th to try and clarify this, and we're still awaiting guidance regarding that. If subscription programs are made available, though, they should be regulated to ensure that Alaskans receive adequate protection when they do purchase a membership. Let me give two examples of what could happen. First, some companies require that patients fly only with them in order to receive their membership benefits. This could result in harm to a patient, an example being that a patient has suffered a heart attack, they've gone to their local hospital, and they've received medicine to dissolve the clot. Sometimes this doesn't work, and the patient needs to be transported for further definitive care. If the aircraft is not immediately available of the service that has provided them with the membership, they could wait hours for this service. The longer the delay, the more heart muscle that can be destroyed and cause long-term effects for this patient. Second, some companies try to sell subscriptions to Medicaid recipients or people who receive benefits from the Indian Health Service. These patients don't need a prescription program because co-payments are not required for them. If they are persuaded to buy a membership, they are purchasing coverage they don't need. Companies who sell to Medicaid or IHS beneficiaries are, in essence, preying on people who can least afford the cost. Regulation is needed to prevent this. Washington State recently passed legislation to exempt membership programs from insurance regulation with minimal consumer protection. Already, revisions are being considered. Airlift Northwest provides memberships in Washington, and we voluntarily formed a reciprocity agreement with another flight program, which is the only other flight program in Washington that provides the same level of quality of service. And we did this so that we could assure that our membership holders would not be delayed in being transported. So if you do decide to move ahead with this legislation, we urge you to consider safeguards to protect Alaskans. In addition to regulations to prevent the situations I described, companies selling memberships should be required to obtain a surety bond from a company licensed to do business in Alaska in an equal amount to the funds to be subscribed, and also to maintain adequate reserve based on the subscription fees. Without this regulation, a company can sell the subscriptions, leave town, and not provide the service. Also, this protection is needed, especially if a company is providing lifetime memberships. Companies should also be required to comply with all state and federal regulations regarding billing and reimbursement for participants. People require air medical transportation when they are critically ill or injured. This is a time for them and their families that is filled with stressing and anxiety. For those of us who practice in this field, we want the best possible care for our patients. We hope you will carefully consider this legislation and not pass something that could ultimately be to the detriment of the patients, not to their benefit. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today. I'm happy to ask any questions, answer any questions. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton.
Under the idea of a subscription service, since we have three different classifications of carriers, if you had bought a subscription and that was with one of the 10 more general, and you had had, I don't know whether it'd be a pregnancy or a heart attack or something that would normally be serviced by one of the more medically specialized services, would this mean that the person would really have to go on not the specialized service that fits their injury or their condition, but would go on the subscription service?
That would depend on the patient. The patient would have to choose to pay the cost if they chose to go with another program versus going with their program that they had paid the membership for. So they wouldn't be covered. That's usually the case. Most programs that do memberships, what they say is this only applies if you fly with us.
Of course.
Thank you.
Representative Roses.
I'm glad I waited on my question from before. It fits a little more appropriate here. In the number of years of experience that you have in this area, have you seen a lot of these service providers come and go?
Representative Roses, in Washington, it's been very limited. I've seen one service provider leave out of Washington when I was there. And to my knowledge, in Alaska, mostly where we serve Southeast Alaska, and I have not seen any other program leave Southeast Alaska.
The reason I asked the question, my concern is, I'll give you a personal example. I bought a piece of equipment one time that had a lifetime guarantee on it. And I asked the person selling the equipment, whose lifetime are we talking about? Mine, my father-in-law's, my daughter's, because there's supposedly a little difference in the age. And I so that's sort of how I feel about this. You buy a subscription to a company, what happens if that company no longer services? Are you then automatically transferred to somebody else, or you just say goodbye to your money? And so that's an area where I have some concern. I think there needs to be some guarantee that whatever service a person subscribes to and pays for, that there actually is some guarantee that that service will be available at the time they need it. That's why I keep asking the questions about the longevity of the people in the business. But some of the other concerns that you brought up were some of the issues that I was going to ask questions about. I do not want to buy a pig in a poke, nor do I want to sell a pig to somebody that's in a poke.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I do want to make a comment myself. As a nurse that's been in the hospital, when I've had to order a medevac for someone, if there was an option of two medevacs, and I know what the doctor would say, listen, you don't have time to wait for this other one. This is your life here, and you're going to have to make a decision. And the doctor would make it very clear what he thought the patient should do. And if they still, that would be up to, it would be their decision. But the doctor or the nurse would be very careful to make sure the patient understood exactly what was going on in their family, you know. So I think what we're going to do is we're going to have Paul Harris from Guardian Flight come up and speak. And maybe you can answer some more questions. state your affiliation and your name. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
For the record, and let us see what's going to happen here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Harris. I'm the General Manager for Guardian Flight. And I would like to speak in favor of House Bill 100. Guardian Flight is an air medical ambulance service. It's headquartered in Fairbanks with bases in Ketchikan, Sitka, Dutch Harbor and provides airplanes to Alaska Regional and Anchorage and airplanes and pilots to Manelik Health Corporation. We are arguably the largest air ambulance service in Alaska, and we feel like that many of these questions that have been asked today have already been answered in much of the other industries that are around. Subscriptions are just that. They're subscriptions. They're a contract between the provider of that subscription and the person that buys it. And so it depends on the reputation of that service provider, whether you're going to buy the subscription and, of course, your need for the product or your perceived need for the product. I know that with the companies that are in Alaska, it's been fairly stable for the last 8 or 10 years. They're about the same ones. There's some smaller services that may change what they do just because of the region that they're working in, but they're always available in an emergency to provide medical care. I like this bill because it doesn't limit to anyone. Any air ambulance service out there has the option of selling a membership if they want to, or a subscription if they want to. I've heard your concerns on lifetime membership, and although I probably wouldn't purchase a lifetime membership myself, there are some people that have enough faith in a business that they would purchase a lifetime membership, and that becomes an agreement. And if I have a lifetime membership, I understand that businesses go out of business, and when they're gone, they're gone, and maybe I'll outlive that. I don't know. I don't have any lifetime memberships, so I think it all gets down to the relationship between the business and the individual that buys it. I know that Guardian Flight provides a service that is a service to the people of Alaska, and the driving force is to provide that service at the lowest possible cost to the people of Alaska. That was our intent when we started talking about this, is how can we improve the system? Well, we can't improve too much, but we can improve this one little piece. We can offer a subscription that allows people to think ahead, plan ahead, so that they're not making that decision when they or their loved ones land in the emergency room and they have to make a decision on who is going to transport them, or leave that decision in the hands of somebody that they don't know, and that could happen. So by having this out, telling people what's available, they get an opportunity to look at it, much like the pre-burial service that my wife and I purchased. We could look at that and say, my loved one's going to be here. They won't have to worry about it. We can think about it now. We don't have to think about it when everybody is stressed out. I think that has a great benefit. I think the savings to the public is a great benefit. I think that it's fair in that everybody gets an opportunity to do it. We're not asking for anything special. Every air ambulance service out there has an opportunity to sell a subscription if that's what they desire to do. It would make sense that you, and maybe there's some unscrupulous operators out there, but I haven't seen any of them in the air ambulance service. Maybe there are. Maybe we'll see them in the future, and we'll have to address that. But I don't think anybody's going to go out and offer a subscription someplace where they can't provide the service, because they are going to get into the situation where they're not available to service that subscription, and I'm sure that the courts would address that and would not look favorably on it.
Okay, let the record show that Representative Fairclough has joined us, and Representative Roses.
Thank you. Well, let me clarify a couple of things before I ask the question, because first of all, I absolutely value the service that all of the air ambulance people provide. I mean, in a state as vast as this one, people literally cannot survive without that kind of service. So I appreciate the efforts that people put into that. But and my question, my line of questioning that I had earlier about worrying about people being able to fulfill their subscription responsibilities has nothing to do with whether I think the company is honorable or not. But in the kind of work that you're in, it's only going to take one aircraft potentially to go down, heaven forbid, before that company may potentially be out of business. And so I'm not concerned and worried about the integrity of the company and whether they're going to be around. I'm concerned about the people that purchase subscriptions and whether or not the service is going to be available. So that's why I was asking the question. But let me proceed with the next question. You indicated that your company would probably be one that would be interested in selling subscriptions, and I noticed in the information we had that there's normally a flat fee of between $50 and $100 for such a fee. Do you have any sense of what your company would charge for such a subscription?
In our research, we think that we can do it for $50 for an individual for an annual and $75 for a family.
And how many potential subscribers would you have to that service in the areas where you work, where you provide service?
But obviously, it depends on the competition. But I think that there's a good chance that we could be up around 100,000 potential subscribers for that individual and family.
So if there were potentially 100,000 that subscribed to that, let's just say half of them did. So you're talking 50,000 people at $50 apiece. Now, that's $2.5 million.
Right.
Okay. What is the typical amount of money that a person would have to pay out of their own pocket if they didn't have the subscription and they had insurance? What is the typical out-of-pocket expense for an individual?
Well, I can't answer that because everybody's insurance is different.
What I
can tell you is that from in 2006, our medevacs that we did, and we did over 1,100 with a projection for about 1,700 this year, but we did over 1,100 medevacs in 2006, and our costs range between $6,000 and $55,000 for a medevac. Now, I know what my insurance is, and having called my insurance and asked them, in most cases, they'd only pay 80% of that. So, for example, if I was medevaced and I had to go to California or Portland, it would be up in that $48,000 to $50,000 range, and my family then would be responsible for 20% of that.
I appreciate that, but using the average numbers that you just spoke about, a 80% pay, so if you're talking about a 20% copay on a $6,000, you're talking $1,200.
I'm
just taking the average.
I understand.
Some are going to be considerably higher, some would be less. So for the $2.5 million that you would collect in annual subscription fees, the amount of copay that would be involved in that, if it were, say, $1,000 a piece, you could airlift 2,500 people for the amount of money that you collected in subscription, that where you would not then be receiving a copay.
Well,
and you transported how many people last year, did you say?
1,100.
1,100.
Okay, so this would each year would cover a little over 2 years worth at the average. So,
well, I know that last year that we had 2.3 million in either uncollectible or underfunded medevacs.
Unfortunately, the difficult part of all the medical industry, which causes all of our insurances to go up. But that puts it into perspective for me. I appreciate your answers.
Representative, who's next? Representative Gardner.
Actually, I think my question may be obsolete. So currently, this means you're not selling subscriptions right now.
No, we're not.
And you do, through the chair, you do individual airlifts privately, and you also do for hospitals, clinics, or whatever?
There was a comment made earlier, and I don't want to confuse you anymore. We always respond when a when a medical provider asks us to respond. So that could be from a clinic, from a hospital, or from an EMS system that's set up in a rural area. Does that get you close to where you're going?
Thank you, yes, except, Madam Chair, do you have, say, contracts where you handle requests on a routine basis from particular hospitals or agencies?
As preferred providers, we do have preferred provider contracts, yes.
Thanks.
Okay. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned one thing about whether it's your service or somebody else's, that they generally would only do it for areas that they what they service. So if someone did the $50 contract from here in Southeastern and it was they were no longer in Juneau, they were out in Hoonah or they were out someplace else, and they had a subscription and they called you for ambulance service. If that wasn't an area that you normally were fulfilling and they had a subscription, do the subscriptions that you would sell specify the area for which that subscription is going to be good, or is that good throughout the state?
Well, for us, we feel like that we can service the whole state with the aircraft that we have and the crews that we have. We feel like that we have the ability to service the state, and we have serviced the state. That's not to say that we can't run out of equipment or out of medical crews, because that happens. The agreement with the subscriber is that we're going to respond to where they're at. And of course, there's all kinds of limitations on that. The FAA was mentioned, and they have limitations. There's also crew time limitations. There's aircraft limitations. What Guardian Flight is committed to is that we're not going to lie about it. We're gonna tell them we will respond. It's going to take 2.5 hours to get there, and then it would be up to the patient to say I can't wait that long, or the doctor to say you can't wait that long and you have to use another service. We will be there, and we do respond from Ketchikan and Sitka to all of those communities that you've mentioned.
Okay.
Follow-up, Representative.
And in the copay amount, if there is not insurance, if it's somebody that's uninsured, what's the how does that work? Does that mean the full bore is there?
Yep, that's what it means.
And as a nurse that's called different medevac companies, I've never been asked, well, do they have insurance? That's never been asked. I mean, usually it's what's wrong with the problem, and where do you want them taken to, and they want a report of what's going on with the patient. But never, ever has the question come up, do they have insurance? So,
if I might, Madam Chair.
Go ahead.
I was asked, are we selling a membership? And I answered that, no, we're not. There is a membership available in the state through a nonprofit. And Charlie Hader, that's the executive director, is here, and she can tell you how that relationship works. There is a membership available. We don't sell it, but we do support it.
Representative Sisna?
Thank you. Madam Chair, and your last answer kind of answers part of my question, right? And I was kind of getting a little confused. About a year and a half ago, I guess it was almost 2 years ago, I was up in Fort Yukon, and was fascinated because I have visited a number of small communities and been looking at health services, and was in Southeast 3 years ago, and they were talking about medevacs that were costing 30 some thousand each and bankrupting communities because people can't always afford it, and somebody pays for it, and oftentimes the community does. And in the Yukon Flats area, as I understand, I thought it was your company that was at least doing the flying, and I might be wrong on that. And I thought it was the air carrier itself that was also providing the medical professionals for the clinics throughout the seven villages, I think it is now, in the Yukon Flats area. Do you know about that program? And that one is fascinating because these communities are communities, as I understand it, that didn't have clinics, had never seen a doctor, did not have medical care, and the Yukon Flats tribal organization, I think, put
CATG.
Together a program. Yeah. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that one? Because it turns around completely what has been going on in rural Alaska forever, and that's the lack of what we all take for granted.
Madam Chair, through the Chair, what's being referred to is the Tanana Chiefs area, and there is an organization in that Tanana Chiefs area, CATG, which is the Council of Athabascan Tribal Governments. And what has happened there is Tanana Chiefs has had a contract that has expired that's been extended with another air carrier to provide medevac service. The CATG has actually done a contract with Guardian Flight to provide medical services in those seven communities. And what we have is two of our doctors that work for us travel to that community. We provide the airplane, we provide the travel, and they travel to the communities and they hold clinics there three times a week. There was some information that I believe come to the committee that those doctors are directing who gets the medevacs. Those doctors are operating on a contract to CATG, and if it's a CATG clinic and a CATG client, then yes, they do come back to Guardian Flight because Guardian Flight has that contract. On the other hand, Tanana Chiefs, if it's a Tanana Chiefs client, they go to Tanana Chiefs because that's where the contract's at. And those doctors understand how that system works and have no problem referring it back and forth. But what you're talking about, and I wish that Dr. Sterling was here to explain the whole thing, or Dr. Dumas, but they've been flying up there for almost 3 years providing services, clinical services in the communities. If I may, Madam Chair, one individual from one of the communities come in to Guardian Flight the other day and wanted to pay these membership to Critical Care, Inc. And we facilitate that. I mean, it's just a matter of getting the paperwork from them, sending the paperwork down, and so we facilitate that as part of our donation to that nonprofit corporation. It was fun to listen to him talk because he's from a rural community that's covered by Indian Health Service. He's covered by Tanana Chiefs. He's covered by CATG. And he comes to us and says, I want to pay for this because it supports my community. He says, besides that, I might need a medevac from someplace other than inside the village one of these days. I think it's a service that's usable out there and is good for the community.
Okay. Representative Faircloth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My apologies for being late. But I do want to come up to speed to make sure that I can vote in a competent way on this issue. I understand that we've talked about 19 different licensed air ambulance services, but I was wondering in trying to look at statute to see if there's a definition for air ambulance service in statute.
There's requirements for air ambulance services, and I rather than try to be an expert on it, I'd like to refer you back to the Department of Health and let them answer that. There's requirements for each one of those different certifications.
And they aren't all air ambulances.
And they're not all air ambulances.
So there's not a definition. That's the answer.
No,
there's a definition for an ambulance, which I found, but not an air ambulance because you can transport by boat or different ways, at least. That's according to code. currently, can you solicit memberships?
Not currently, we cannot as a profit business. We cannot solicit memberships.
Only a nonprofit.
Only a nonprofit.
And this doesn't allow that to happen.
Well, it doesn't stop it from happening. This bill allows a for-profit business to go out and solicit for memberships or subscriptions.
That's not how I read the law, I guess. It says it is amended by adding a new section to read F. The title does not apply to air ambulance services. And am I on the wrong bill?
No. Mm-hmm. You're on the right bill.
I'm trying to get to how we're allowing.
You need legal here, I think, for.
Yeah, I don't.
For that.
Yeah, don't we? We'll get somebody there. Up here okay, in a little then, bit to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay, then another question I have is, do we have defined EMS boundaries then inside of the state of Alaska?
Mm-mm. Again,
I see people shaking their heads no. And mm-hmm. So to the committee.
We do have boundaries as far as I can remember when we were in Tok. It would go, we could, lots of times would take a patient to this point, and another ambulance or EMT service would pick it up sometimes and go on. Sometimes we would go all the way, and so it just depends on the situation. But everybody kind of knows where their region is.
Mm-hmm. It's the state. The state actually manages the EMS service.
I mean, that's so totally regulated. Yeah. This is Kathy, right? Kathy, come on up and just take a seat there, and maybe you can answer some of these questions a little bit.
Thank you. I'm still Kathy McLaren with the Department of Health. We don't have specific limits on where you can respond and where you can't respond. So some air medical services choose to respond in a defined area or to a patient population, while other services travel statewide. One example is North Slope Borough Critical Care Ambulance Service pretty much serves within their borough region, although they will go out when requested. Other services like Providence Alaska Regional Lifeguard, Guardian Flight, and Aeromed are more apt to be statewide services. The definition that you asked about air ambulances, we don't define air ambulances. We define medevac service, critical care air ambulance, and specialty aeromedical transport team, and those definitions can be found in 7AAC 26999 under the EMS regulations.
And so you have specific criteria for the licensing requirement of these air ambulance services?
Yes, ma'am, we do. There's three levels, and that's found in Article 3 of the EMS regs, 7AAC 26310 to 390.
Where I'm driving to is inside municipalities, we have specific set up EMS areas that require only response inside those areas.
Correct. In the municipality of Anchorage, there's a municipal medical team, and private ambulance company within that boundary can't do 911 response. Anchorage Fire does that response, and Chugiak Fire and Girdwood Fire Department does that, the emergency 911 response. We don't have a situation like that set up for the rest of the state. And in the air medical arena, it really is more market-driven. There's not a certificate of need, and we don't say you can go here, you can't go here.
And so where my question is going is Medicare and Medicaid specifically has defined requirements for people being charged the same types of services. Does that not extend to the rest of the state? So if you're inside of the municipality of Anchorage specifically, you can't charge a different fee to transport people inside that geography. And so you're telling me that's not the same for the rest of the state?
I am not as familiar with Representative through the chair, I'm not as familiar with Medicaid, Medicare reimbursement issues. Our credentialing just says that you are meeting our standards. And so we say that in order to be certified as a medevac service, you must have appropriate planes, appropriate personnel, equipment, training, and that's what we are regulating, and an organization that applies with us and meets those requirements is permitted to provide care any place in Alaska.
She was up earlier and gave her whole testimony. So
I'm sorry.
I'm still not getting the answer.
Follow up, Representative Fairclough.
Could you, from your perspective, talk to me about 21 103.021, and you think that that particular statement allows air ambulance services to be exempt from insurance regulation?
Section 2 of Bill 100?
Yeah.
Our department is not taking a position on this bill, and this looks more like insurance regulation. I'm much more comfortable speaking to AS 1808, as that's the part of the the statutes that is in my
jurisdiction
authority.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Seaton?
Yeah, I had a question for Mr. Harris, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, it sounds like there's a model out here that uses a subscription service and provides health services to communities on a contract basis, and it's limited to nonprofit. Now, if we would allow, as this bill does, individual air ambulance services to have that subscription service for their business model, their profit model, to offset their costs, is that in any way going to diminish the probability of having those same subscription services take place for providing the community medical services such as is being done under the nonprofit model?
I don't know. It comes down to what the market out there is going to support. But speaking specifically to this issue and this air ambulance membership bill, the primary reason that we went with a Guardian Flight went with a nonprofit is to make sure that, because we felt this was a service that the public could benefit from, and the only way to do it was through a nonprofit, and so we supported the nonprofit in offering this. Will that nonprofit stay viable? I believe so. There is no reason that we can't do a partnership with that nonprofit and continue to provide that support to the nonprofit. But what it allows us to do is actually use our ability to market and our name as part of the marketing to put some strength behind it. We can go out and show that we have 8 King Airs and 2 Lear Jets. We have 115 employees that stand behind this. We have the certification. We have the insurance, and we have the training to provide this service. And we have a history that being able to provide it. The nonprofit is marketing a feel-good. They don't have any control of it at all, other than they're marketing what Guardian Flight's already doing. And we're willing to do that. I think the nonprofit will stay in existence. We want it to, and we'll continue to support that nonprofit because we agree with what that nonprofit does. That nonprofit supports pre-hospital and EMS training. And to make this system work, we've got to have good EMS and pre-hospital care out there.
Okay, what I'd like to do is just kind of wait a little bit and talk to somebody that's online. And Tom Bailey, are you online?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yes. And thank you for where are you at?
I am in Puerto Vallarta.
Okay, in Mexico. All right.
Oh boy.
So go ahead and give us your testimony, and then we've just kind of suspended things here so that you could go ahead and speak.
I appreciate that, Madam Chair. And committee members, thank you for giving me the opportunity to present testimony on House Bill 100. For the record, my name is Tom Bailey, and I'm the manager of Providence, Alaska Medical Center's Air Ambulance Service, Lifeguard Alaska. Lifeguard Alaska is a rotor and fixed-wing air ambulance service providing emergent medical transports and specialty transports throughout Alaska, and have done so as a dedicated service since 1986, touching the lives of over 25,000 Alaskans and non-Alaskans, from premature infants to adults. I would like to go on the record first to thank Representatives Coghill and Wilson for their efforts in trying to decrease the cost risk for those Alaskans with grave illnesses or injuries, but would also like to share with you my concerns with the bill as written. As I understand, subscription services, an individual or a group of people as in a family pay an annual fee or purchase a lifetime membership, and in return they receive air ambulance service when in need from the air ambulance service selling them the membership. The membership company then bills and accepts assignment of pay from whomever they are covered, and no cost other than the membership cost is incurred by the patient being transported. If the service is not available at the time of need, they either have to wait or another service performs the transport without the benefits of the membership. In other words, they or their payer, i.e. Medicaid, Medicare, IHS, private insurance companies, are billed the full price. Most people who have been seriously ill understand that the cost of care can be very high, and in some cases, people have put their own outcomes in jeopardy as a result of trying to cut corners or base decisions on economics versus the path with the greatest likelihood for a positive outcome. A potential example of this is, and I think you heard this earlier, the patient who is in an isolated village or community and having a heart attack and belongs to a subscription for an air ambulance that's not available for maybe hours sometimes, and chooses to wait versus allowing the use of another provider, and either succumbs to the heart attack or loses so much heart muscle that he or she becomes a cardiac cripple, and then in some cases are dependent on the government for care throughout the rest of their life. In the case of a trauma patient who chooses to wait for the next available subscription flight, he or she would reduce the likelihood of a positive outcome. In this case, the golden hour of trauma kicks in, which indicates that if his or her chance of survival due to injuries is 50%, after 1 hour it decreases to 25%, or 2 hours, 12.5%, etc. Again, the desire to save expenses could potentially result in death or long-term disability. There is also a potential for abuse of the service, which could leave those most in need of the service waiting for the next available aircraft. In addition to potential harm to the patient, I believe the question exists regarding the legality of membership program for the coverage of patients who are Medicare, IHS, or Medicaid eligible. Coverage for these patients already exists. In the case of the Medicaid patient, there is no copay, and by subscribing to a membership, they in essence are being charged a copay that they, one, are not legally required to pay, and two, the provider is not legally allowed to charge for. As you're probably aware, a large number of rural Alaskans are Medicaid eligible, and there would be little, if any, benefit to them, and if subscribed to a membership program, would be paying much needed money for a service they are already covered for. Another issue in regards to the consumer's lack of protection to the consumer in the event the provider service goes out of business or leaves the state. I believe you heard this as well. The consumer is then paid for a service that they will not receive without protection of a refund. I would also like to point out that I'm not personally aware of any service in the state of Alaska in an emergency situation that asks for proof of insurance or benefit coverage before transporting a seriously ill patient. In fact, it is the last thing on our minds. As a provider for the citizens of Alaska, Providence writes off millions of dollars in charitable care every year, and Lifeguard Alaska in particular operates at a loss to provide this much-needed service. I do not believe this bill will benefit the providers or the majority of those provided for. Thank you again for allowing me this time to testify.
Okay. Thank you. And we have a presentation that is going to take about an hour. So what I'm going to do is going to.
I do too, for this person.
Do you have a question for Mr. Bailey?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And most of the things he talked about was with insurance and not about this bill. So, go ahead and ask the question, Representative Sisna.
And Representative Roses, I don't want to knock you out, but In my conversations, and in fact, I called Yukon Flats Clinic this afternoon, trying to get the woman that I had talked to when I was visiting there, and she was out of town. But I was asking them about the whole issue of, because I, when they were describing the service to me, it didn't sound like we were talking, they were talking about medevacs at all. They were talking more about health maintenance and preventing medevacs, and that that was the entire reason that they had gone to this membership kind of program. They were saying, when I said medevacs, the woman was replacing the woman that I meant to talk to and wasn't used to, I think, talking to somebody asking the kind of questions I was, but I was saying medevacs, and she was saying, I don't know what you're talking about, and she said, we have travel. We talk about it as travel. And because they go to those communities three times a week, and because they're constantly focused on, and that's what they were saying, on prevention. Now, my question is...
Who are you asking the question of?
Mr. Harris, if I got it right? Yeah, Mr. Harris. Well, I'm wondering if you consider the services that you give to Yukon Flats medevacs, or do you consider it travel? Because you're transporting a number of people back and forth, is what I'm understanding.
Through the chair, the service that we provide to CATG is not medevac. It's a clinical service. Those people that need a higher level of care are medevac, and there is travel that's different from that. We don't transport persons in need of medical care on the airplane that flies the doctors out there to provide those clinics. That would be a whole different service.
Follow-up, Representative Sisson, you know what, I'm gonna cut you off because we're going to have to, I've got to hear some testimony of some people that have come from out of town and will not be able to be here next time.
Thank you.
We're going to continue on this, and I don't mean to...
Madam Chair, I'm just going to remind you later that you're going to save some time for me to the sponsor to make sure that we're providing for, because I think there's a need for what Guardian Air is doing in the area that I've been talking about, the Yukon Flats area, and other areas ought to have that.
Yeah, but that doesn't have anything to do with this bill, so.
Well, it may.
Okay,
it may.
Thank you. Representative Roses.
Thank you. Just my question was for Mr. Harris, so I didn't want to keep Mr. Bailey on the phone
okay.
if we didn't have questions for him.
Okay.
Because it's probably going to cost him the cost of several Mai Tais to stay on the phone.
You have a question for Mr. Bailey?
Yes, I do.
Okay, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Did I hear you... your statement that you think that would probably be illegal to sell these subscriptions to anybody that's Medicaid or Indian Health Service eligible because it would be a copay if they ever basically the service itself, the selling that would be as a copay to which would be not allowed under either of those conditions of Medicaid or Indian Health Service?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, you're correct. I believe that for Medicaid patients, that by charging them a fee for that subscription, you indeed are charging them a copay. And I also believe that there is some precedent set through the OIG in terms of the Medicare patients that would put in question the legality of it as well.
Okay, thank you. And Linda Bailey is here, our Commissioner of Insurance, and
Linda Hall.
Linda Hall. but she can come back next time. Can you come back next time?
No.
You can't. Well, Linda, come forward then. And maybe you can answer some of these questions.
I'm sure with the weather outside, she wouldn't mind being with Mr. Bailey today.
Any of them, right?
I think we all might. Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, Linda Hall from the Division of Insurance. And I will try to be brief, but I feel compelled to, I think, do maybe some clarification originally going in that will answer some of the questions and potentially some misunderstandings of some of the things. One, I would emphasize that this bill's intention has nothing to do with provision of ambulance services. It has nothing to do with health insurance. It has to do with subscriptions to for air ambulance services. And I'm going to start with, there really is no difference in how we regulate for-profits or not-for-profits. So when we talk about in this particular bill air ambulance service subscriptions, there's not a difference. I think someplace along the line there has been a misunderstanding of Chapter 87 in the insurance title, Title 21, that that applies somehow to entities. It's actually called Hospital and Medical Service Corporations. There are two hospital and medical service corporations in Alaska. One of them is Premera Blue Cross. I'm sure you're all familiar with that name. The second one is Vision Plan Services, Vision Service Plans, VSP. That is a vision insurance provider. Those are the only two hospital medical service corporations in Alaska. That chapter specifically excludes a bunch of things because we do not consider them hospital medical service corporations. So when we talk about the difference between for-profits and not-for-profits, that's really not applicable to what we're talking about in this bill. I hate to throw that monkey wrench out because there's been a lot of discussion about for-profits and not-for-profits, but it's really not applicable. We don't regulate insurance products based on whether they're for-profit or not-for-profit. I mean, in general, they are, the majority of them are certainly for-profit. The exclusions in Chapter 87 that say this chapter does not apply to A, B, C, D, E are only to say that chapter does not apply to them. It does not mean Title 21 does not apply to them. So with that, I would like to say, one, I do support this piece of legislation. What I think it does, however, is not interfere with the provision or not of air ambulance services. The Department of Health and Social Services has spoken about their credentialing, and I certainly don't want to interfere with that because it's not anything we have any expertise in. Where we've run into an issue, and I think you have some bullet points from a study done in Washington recently, and Washington did pass very similar legislation upon which this bill was modeled. They did a survey of 27 states around the country. The Washington Office of the Insurance Commissioner had found that air ambulance memberships, doesn't have anything to do with the service, were insurance under their statute. As a result of that designation, that classification of a product as insurance, they said unless you become an insurer, you can't offer an insurance product, and to become an insurer is a very onerous process. The air ambulance services that were told they could not sell memberships stopped providing service to the San Juan Islands. So the impetus behind the legislation in Washington was because you had air ambulance services stop providing service because they couldn't sell these memberships. I think some of the testimony you've heard here today is kind of the opposite of that. Well, what I would say to you is our definition of insurance is broad. I will actually read it to you. I know you don't want to hear this, but I think I need to.
Please.
I try not to be really boring, but sometimes I am. Insurance means a contract whereby, it's just a contract, one undertakes to indemnify another or pay or provide a specified or determinable amount or benefit upon determinable contingencies. Now, that probably sounds like gibberish. What it says is somebody says, I'll either pay on your behalf, I'll provide a service on your behalf when something happens. That could cover a myriad of activities, all of which we have the ability to say are insurance. And regularly do say, we consider that to be an insurance product. In the realistic world of insurance regulation, for us to regulate somebody selling an insurance product, they have to become an insurer. That's how you get to sell an insurance product. To be an insurer in Alaska, you have to have a specified by statute amount of statutory capital and surplus. Minimum you're going to have to start an insurance company is $2 million. $1 million in capital, $1 million in surplus to start. So you get a certificate of authority which says now you're an insurer. Now that you are blessed with getting the certificate of authority, you also get to have an annual audit by your CPA. How much does that cost? $10,000, roughly? Minimum. I'm hurrying. I really am. I'm really sorry. You also get to have us come in and do a financial exam every 3 years. I would use a very conservative $30,000 for that. We have exams that range up to $170,000, $80,000, $200,000 because of the complexity. But small companies, I've got three as examples, $83,000, $69,000, $123,000. That's what it takes to become an insurer. If we say this air ambulance membership is an insurance product, which we probably can under our statute, then we have to make that air ambulance company selling the membership an insurance company. Are we going to take one of these service providers and say, okay, Charlie, pony up, $2 million and we'll be in to examine you for which you pay? I mean, that's the practical, and I'm not being flip. I'm trying to hurry. That's the practical reality of what we're dealing with. The bill's intent is merely to say that these subscriptions are not insurance. It's not to impact whether you have ambulance service. It's not to impact we consumers. We have never had a consumer complaint. The 27 states that were surveyed as a result of the Washington study, none ever reported a consumer complaint. We still have the fraud department in the Department of Law. Ed Sniffen runs a department where they do consumer protection on a regular basis. There's nothing to say if there's not a consumer complaint, they can't go there. So with that, I'm going to stop if you have questions, and I really appreciate you letting me testify because I'm going to a colder place next week, not to wherever.
Representative Gardner.
I just want to make sure I absolutely understand. You're saying that you support this bill, and what the bill really does is put into statute that selling subscriptions to air ambulances is not insurance.
That's correct.
As follow-up, does that mean that we would not as have any way as a state to regulate and have the statutory insurance, for example, for the commission, for the consumer? They don't have the protection that the insurance regulations provide to them in terms of the fact they've bought into something, maybe bought a lifetime contract, and the company could go belly up and they're just out of luck.
Can I editorialize as a response, Madam Chair? Through the Chair, Representative Gardner. I probably would put a restriction on lifetime memberships, frankly. But I think as consumer protection, we still have a consumer protection division, and they are perfectly capable of enforcing our consumer protection laws. It just wouldn't be the insurance laws. But I, too, share your concern with the concept of a lifetime membership.
Thank you.
And that's one of the reasons why we're not moving the bill out today, because we're listening to all these things, and there will be a different bill by the time it comes back, more than likely. So, anyway, anybody else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else that will be unable to come again next time? Okay, come on. Are you Charlie? I've got you down here. Okay, come on up. And this is Charlie Hader? Hatter.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. It's Charlie Hader.
Okay.
I thank you, Madam Chair and the committee, for your time. And I'm here today just to answer any questions that you have about the current state of the memberships that Critical Care currently offers. We are a nonprofit dedicated to providing support for education, training, and research for Alaska's medical personnel. So we want to make sure that when people in Alaska, who are often isolated and often don't have the access to care that some of us do in Ketchikan and Juneau and Anchorage, that they do have the best care available. And so we provide grants and scholarships for folks to make sure that their training's up to date, the certifications are up to date. If they need something in their communities that they don't get otherwise, for example, last year CCI donated to Skagway for them to have a child birthing class because they'd never had that before. So that's what our mission is, and that is what my job is, to fulfill that mission. One of the ways, the main way that we do that, excuse me, is because we are a member-funded nonprofit. The advantage that our members receive is what we call the critical care advantage. And that is where if they are a CCI member and if they do need emergency medical services and they fly with Guardian Flight, they will receive no balance bill. Also, our members, I recently started in January, and so there's things that we're doing now that have been done before, but there was a lapse. We're having quarterly newsletters. We're going to be having information for our folks so that they can know exactly what their money's going toward. Since I started, 100% of our donations go towards providing education, training, and research. We would like to continue to do that. And we do support House Bill 100 because it's good for the people of Alaska. It's good for patient care to ensure that, that folks are receiving the best care possible. And also, air ambulance services then don't have to be the final assailant when people are going through traumatic situations. The last thing you want to do after you get home from a life-altering sickness or traumatic experience is receive a bill for over $100,000 that you may or may not have the ability to pay. So we want to ensure that these companies that are here in Alaska providing these services will continue to be here, and that is also why we support House Bill 100.
Okay, Representative
Seaton. So I guess I'm a little confused. You're a nonprofit that sells a subscription, basically?
We don't sell subscriptions. Our people donate to us, and we call them members.
Okay.
So we have memberships.
I guess I'm trying to figure out where, if this subscription service is available to individual air ambulances or air medical to for them to sell directly to patients, and so that donation or that money doesn't come to the nonprofit because it's being paid to the for-profit air ambulance company, how does that allow you to continue as the nonprofit?
We will continue to solicit donations to fulfill our mission, and we'll do that in a variety of ways. We have folks who, I have a 7-year-old woman who called me 2 weeks ago and is so supportive of what we're trying to do that she donated $2,000 on behalf of her and her husband, just so that she knows that the people that are working on her in the most critical time have that opportunity to fulfill their certification, their training, and the research potential that they have.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. Can you tell me if subscribers would have priority if there are, say, two calls that come in different directions from and only one plane available?
Madam Chair, what I can say to that is that because I'm not familiar with the other air ambulance agencies in the state, I know that Guardian Flight specifically will go to the place where they're most needed. They don't ask how they pay. They don't ask if they have insurance, and they're going to go where they're most needed. And if they're unavailable, they tell them straight up. Does that answer your question?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very
much. Thank you for your time.
Is there anyone else here that cannot come back on Tuesday? Oh.
Yes, Madam Chair. This is a TOLC LIO. We have Leif Wilson here that would be a hardship for him to come back if he can get in today.
All right.
Thank you.
And if you can go, you know, try not to repeat what's already been said, but go ahead and give your testimony.
Okay, Madam Chair, I'll do my best. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Leif Wilson. I'm the President and Director of Operations of 40 Mile Air. We are a medevac service that is based in Tok, serving the Upper Tanana area. The first and most serious problem that I I'd like to go on record as opposing House Bill 100 as it is written at this time. The first and most serious problem that I see with the membership service is that it effectively strips the local provider from their ability to choose the medevac service that is most suited to the needs of the patient for the particular problem that exists at that time. Here in Tok, there has been memberships sold from a medevac service, and so I've had firsthand experience with it. At times I am a pilot that flies the medevac aircraft, and we work in conjunction with the Tok area EMS that provide our medical personnel. In the cases that we've seen here, the patient that was in the clinic insisted that they wait for the subscription, the medevac service that they had the subscription with. They were paying their $50 a month. They needed a medevac. They wanted to get something for that money and were willing to wait the 3.5 to 4 hours that it took for that service to come out of Fairbanks. The plus that we have for operating out here in Tok is our response time. We have a 30-minute response time. I've lived in Tok here for the past 40 years, and I can tell you without a doubt that 98% of the time there's a patient that needs a medevac in Tok. We can have that patient in Fairbanks or Anchorage before any of the larger regional medevac services that are based out of Fairbanks or Anchorage would even be able to arrive in Tok. That is even if the weather allows them to get to Tok. We don't have a precision instrument landing system here in Tok like the larger cities have. So there are times that they are not able to land here, but we can take off. I think that the choice needs to be there for the provider to be able to call the service that can provide the best patient care. I'm not going to tell you that is always us in this area. We kind of confine ourselves to the local area here and keep an airplane ready to go 24/7. There are times I've seen where there's been, for instance, a baby that needed some specialty care, and the time wasn't super critical. They've launched an airplane out of Anchorage or Fairbanks that had the equipment that they needed. And I think that is something that needs to be retained. I don't understand, you know, most of the patients, and the patient that I was talking about that was willing to wait for the subscription medevac service that he had was a patient that was covered under Medicaid. We told him, the provider told him, look, you're covered under Medicaid. There's not going to be any charge to you. It doesn't matter. He insisted on waiting. He was paying his $50 a month.
But, it's not $50 a month, but it's $50 a year. But I'm going to have to end this because we have another presentation, but we will be starting on Tuesday with a continuation of this. Is it Tuesday? Thursday. Next Thursday with this bill. So I'm really sorry, but we're way behind. And you're welcome to call again next Tuesday, and if you want, or next Thursday, and give more details. So thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll close testimony on this bill, and I'm going to pull the information that we've gotten. The sponsor of the bill, Karen's been over there busily writing, and so we will, I'm sure by the time we get back, we'll have a committee substitute. So, and if any members of the committee have items that they would like to give to Karen for her to work on, that would be wonderful. So thank you very much. And now what I'd like to do is, what did I do with my list here. Here we go. We would like to have our presentation on strengthening families to come forward, and that's Shirley Pitts and Claudia Shanley. And if you can come forward, and I apologize. And, you know, if there's three of you, just, you know, if there's more of you, just pull the chairs up and come forward. No problem. And I'm sorry, you never know how long things are going to take, as you can see.
We'll do our brief first.
So anyway, go ahead. We're really excited about your presentation, Strengthening Families. I've have become involved in this a little bit myself, and I just want to share it and let as many people as we can hear about it also. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Claudia Shanley. I'm the Systems Reform Administrator in the Office of Children's Services in the Department of Health and Social Services. As the Chair said, about a month ago, Shirley Pitts and I were able to accompany Representative Wilson, Representative Coghill, and Senator Betty Davis to a National Conference on State Legislatures meeting in Chicago, the purpose of which was to invite states legislatures to learn about a movement, if you will, called Strengthening Families. Strengthening Families Through Early Care and Education was an opportunity for us to spend some time with our legislative members and several other states learning about what was happening around the country, and we appreciate the opportunity at your request to present this information today. We will do an abbreviated version, we promise. We are going to provide some foundational information very quickly and then talk specifically about the Strengthening Families Initiative in Alaska and hear from one of our pilot sites here in Alaska as well. We're here just to share information. We're not asking for anything. We are, again, doing this at the request of Representative Wilson, and we thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Shirley Pitts, and I'm the Early Childhood Comprehensive Systems Coordinator in the Office of Children's Services for Health and Social Services. You can hear me? Okay. So I'd like to start with just giving some background information, a little foundation about why this program is so important. And I'd like to point out the name Strengthening Families Through Early Care and Education. It's really a child abuse and prevention program that is embedded or implemented through early care and learning programs. You've probably been seeing more of this kind of information about the importance of the early years. And specifically this morning, this afternoon, we wanted to talk just a little bit about brain development, because that is one of the things that makes this program so critical. As you've probably heard, the early years are very, very important in terms of brain development, that's when the most rapid brain development happens. And we know that that's not only because of the genetics that come with the child, but it's also very much a part of the experiences that they have. And based on this, the early years, the quality of the brain architecture that is developed in those early years really sets the foundation for later learning and health and social and emotional development. We know that it's all about relationships. That's the active ingredients. We know that young children who have very nurturing, loving families and environments get off to a good start. And generally, that means that they have very positive brain development, which, again, is a foundation for later. We also know that children who don't have those protective relationships, that aren't surrounded by nurturing caregiving, and are exposed to what we call persistent stress, actually have physiological changes. The body produces chemicals and hormones when we're under stress, which can impact brain development. One of those is cortisol, another one is adrenaline. So one of the things that's helpful to us is if we can understand the biology of stress, it can help us understand the differences for children in terms of their learning behavior, particularly as it applies to abuse and neglect and perhaps domestic violence. So we want to talk just a little bit about stress. There's positive stress, which you can see in this little guy's face. He's learning to ride a bike, and he's obviously very excited about this. So he has a little extra adrenaline flowing in his body, and he's very excited about this. This is what we call positive stress. It's moderate, it's short-lived, is something we all need sometimes just to get out of our chairs, right? Then we have what's called tolerable stress, and that's when situations happen for young children. Perhaps it's a divorce situation. It may be I lost my dog. You know, there are hard things that happen. But what buffers this is that children are surrounded by supportive relationships. And that really does make a difference physiologically if young children have caring relationships to help them manage their stress. The one that is not so great is our what we call toxic stress, and that's when children are under strong and prolonged stressful situations. Again, to go back to the biology of that, that does have a hormonal impact on children, and when that is prolonged, it does have it can have a physiological impact. There aren't protective relationships to buffer that for some children. We have some statistics about the report of harm by age group, just to call your attention to really, again, those early years, our 0 to 5-year-olds. We see that 35% of our reports of harm are in this age group. So it's an age group that's particularly vulnerable, and it also is over 30% of our reports, which is of great concern. So what developmental science really points us to is kind of a two-pronged approach to dealing with this. One is a universal and sort of coordinated process for children and families to access supportive programs, and that's kind of what strengthening families is. There's also targeted programs that are particularly interested in kids who are already experiencing this toxic stress. A graphic way of looking at this and really the importance of the early years and how to alter outcomes, to have children with positive outcomes, what we want to do is to increase protective factors, which we're going to talk to you about, and decrease the risk factors. So what is kind of interesting about this chart is that you'll see that the trajectory goes up very rapidly in the beginning, in the very early years. And again, it's because of that rapid development that young children, that whole foundational piece that's being laid down for our young kids. And the more we can do to bolster that with protective factors, the better the outcomes are.
So the Strengthening Families Through Early Care and Education project came from the Center for the Study of Social Policy, which is an agency in Washington, D.C. They focus on many issues related to child abuse and neglect prevention, as well as early care and education. In 2001, the center was looking for an approach to deal with child abuse prevention. They wanted to do something systematic. They wanted to do something national in scope. They wanted to do something that would impact large numbers of very young children. And they wanted it to happen long before that abuse or neglect ever occurred. So very much at the primary prevention end. Some of the old ideas that the center staff explored was really looking at how child abuse prevention efforts had been carried out before and continue to be carried out somewhat today. That being targeting at-risk families. And at-risk families are identified as folks that really looking at characteristics among that are common among families experiencing neglect and abuse, identifying families that might be at risk. But in contrast, and also truly in the work that we do, we sometimes see sort of the highlighting bad parents. The new idea is really to look at, in contrast, the protective factors approach, looking for attributes that might serve as buffers to those at-risk sort of behaviors, helping parents who would otherwise be at risk by finding alternate resources, supports, and coping strategies that will allow them to parent differently, especially under stress. And so the new idea that the center came up with is we need to go where kids already are. We shouldn't be looking at some new program to put in place, but let's look at a universal approach so that strengthening families and those protective factors are good for all children and families. And since children, for the most part, birth to five, over 60% of our kids in Alaska between birth and five are in some kind of out-of-care home situation, let's go where those kids are. let's offer support to parents in ways that is something for everyone to obtain in an early care and education program, but it's not a targeting approach. And let's do it before anything bad happens in those families. So the hypothesis was that early care and education are the place to do child abuse prevention work, primary prevention work, because there's daily contact with parents and children when parents drop their children off and when they pick them up. Child care teachers are in a unique place to have intimate relationships with those parents and the rest of their families. It also, again, is the universal approach. Everyone is getting the same intervention, if you will. We're not targeting people. And early care and education programs, by virtue of being with families every day, can be an early response, early warning and response system. The framework, again, I think just reiterates that it, from the center's perspective, they wanted to focus on strengths in families rather than all the deficits or at-risk behaviors. It was really important that the center look at hard evidence that support the prevention efforts. So the strengthening families model is based on research and research and research, and it is important to child abuse advocates, I would say everyone, to really be looking at evidence-based practices these days. We also, again, wanted to go where the center wanted to go, where children are, where their parents are, and impact folks at that place, early care and education programs. And this is the work that those teachers already do with parents and children. And it needed to be understandable to everybody because child abuse and neglect prevention is a community issue. So the center gathered up all that information, and what they did after they thought about this and examined the research is they went around the country and they looked for exemplary early care and education programs. And they said, what is it in your program? What is it specifically that you do that helps to prevent child abuse and neglect? And so here we have our famous logic model over on the right, is the actual, the outcome of the prevention, and identifying the protective factors. And we're just going to list those out to move to the next slide, because we'll talk about those a little bit more. This is the last chance. I know. So I just like to give you a couple of examples.